And I haven't found necessary to go to jail, steal anything over $50, or take a drink since the 1st of March of 1976, and I'm real happy about that, I'll tell you. I want to, first of all, thank Dan and Randy for inviting me and the rest of the committee for inviting me to the Georgia Prepaid conference. The Prepaid conference. I see enough bald heads here that you'll remember this. Remember old Kenny Delmar on the radio show a long, long, long time ago? He's on Fred Allen's show, and he played a character on the radio called Senator Claghorn. And I can just hear Senator Claghorn says, this is a prepaid. I'm saying this is a prepaid conference here, so I know you're prepaid. I know you're prepaid, aren't you, boy? Yeah. So I'd never heard of a prepaid. I think that's fantastic. Great day. You all know drunks, don't you? This is a great crowd. I love drunks. I think they're the greatest people in the world. The hotel's nice. The towels are so fluffy, I won't be able to close my suitcase when I go home. nice place to stay, and I appreciate all that. I have some sad news. And everybody in this room has a dear, dear friend. Even drunks have dear, dear friends. And this man, he knows nothing about AA, nor does he need to. But he practices the 12 steps and has been for as long as I've known him. And we were in flight school together a long, long, long time ago. And we flew combat together in Vietnam. And we were with the same airline together. And we were both vice presidents of the same airline together. And he's one of the dearest friends I've ever had or ever will have. And unfortunately, his wife is dying. And I have to leave tomorrow morning. I'm going to have to leave early and drive back to Corinth, where I'm from, in order to go to St. Paul, Minnesota, for her services. And her name is Jo Schellinger. And I would like for everybody in this room to offer up a prayer for God, as we understand God, to accept her with open arms, because she's one of those people that she's a saint, and she's one of those people that practices the program and doesn't know a darn thing about it. So I'm just happy that I'm able to do that. I would have drunk over it if I've been still alive. I read some things before I start any talk, and this is no exception. Tonight I'll do the same thing, and I call these five observations of AA speakers, and it goes like this. Number one, AA speakers are just plain drunks, no different from you, believe me. And number two, they are not brighter or more sober or more successful or certainly not more spiritual. They're just more eager to hear the sound of their own voice. So. And number three, AA speakers are not special people. We come in all shapes, sizes, periods of sobriety, and levels of humility just like you. And number four, use caution when you hear any AA speaker holding a closed-door session for inner circle spirituality, because we can guarantee that they're not spreading a message, but they may be spreading a disease, all right? And finally, beware of any AA speaker who uses an inordinate amount of profanity. It's immature, it's inappropriate, it's unacceptable, and it certainly isn't part of any AA program we're familiar with. Well, the first time I read those, I sat down. I didn't have anything else to say, really. But I think it's important for me to read those. A lot's changed. I'm going to read something else. This will be the most important thing that I read tonight. Y'all standing up, and the last guy in buys the ice cream. You're it. there's a bunch of chairs. Hold up your hand if you got some extra chairs next to you there. Oh, yeah, there's plenty of chairs. And unless you're taking medicine, why don't you come on up here and sit down and have a seat. Well, you can tell they're drunks. They haven't moved, following good orderly direction. This will be the most important thing I read tonight. Chapter 3, more about alcoholism. Most of us have been unwilling to admit we're real alcoholics. No person likes to think he is bodily and mentally different from his fellows. Therefore, it is not surprising that our drinking careers have been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove we could drink like other people. The idea that somehow, someday, we will control and enjoy our drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many pursue it into the gates of insanity and death. First line, second paragraph. Here's the kicker. We learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. On March the 1st of 1976, through a great deal of misunderstandings and a wee bit of tough luck, I shook two in a Lady Kenmore box under a bridge in North Kansas City, Missouri. It had not been my intent in life to end up in a box under a bridge in North Kansas City, Missouri. But you see, I really didn't have a choice. I'm one of those alcoholics, agree with me or not, I don't care, that I was predestined to have the bug. You know, I had the curse. And I ended up there. That morning dawned like a lot of mornings hadn't in a long time. Because I was, see if you recognize this. You've been there. I couldn't get drunk and I couldn't get sober. Been there, haven't you? Most horrible feeling in this world. And a lucid thought came to me, perhaps the first lucid thought I'd had in a long time. And the lucid thought was simply this. I don't want to live anymore. You know, I don't want to, you know, bellyache to somebody and say, oh, please help me, I'm going to commit suicide. I just want it out. I want it off that squirrel cage that Creighton had started and had developed for himself. I just want it out. Now, I was wearing my wardrobe. I had an old pair of marine green wool breeches on, zippers rusted shut, and had an old pair of yellow tennis shoes for the same reason the zipper is rusted shut. And an old raggedy shirt and a leather flying jacket. And that was my wardrobe. I was down to it. And I had 40 cents in my pocket. And the only reason I remember I had 40 cents will become clear in just a moment. And I knew where a car was parked. Didn't belong to me. Belonged to some people who had been friends of mine and later would become friends again. And I knew where this car was parked, so, and I hadn't had a bath in a long time. And so, smelling like a goat, I trotted down to the bus city bus line, had my last drink of Aqua Velva, which had become my drink of choice, and got on that bus, and guess what the bus fare was? 40 cents. There are no coincidences. I could have had any seat on the bus I wanted, of course. Didn't smell very good. And all of a sudden, a placidity came over me. A calmness came over me. And I thought, and I was probably as calm as I had been in a long time because I'd made that decision. I rode out and got off the bus and went up to the garage of this home, and I broke into the garage, and I found the vacuum cleaner hose and stuck one end in the tailpipe and the other in the car. Some of you could write the rest of the script to yourself. And I found the keys, and I put them in the ignition, and I got in, turned the ignition on, and nothing happened. And if you're bent on suicide, you screwed your whole day up right there, I'll tell you. But here's what did happen. Out of futility, out of absolute futility, that I couldn't kill myself, I bottomed out. I surrendered. As I used to love to hear Chuck Chamberlain say this when he'd talk about the third step. And he'd just boom it out. He'd say, it's all about surrender! And that's exactly what it is. And I surrendered. And so did you, or you wouldn't be sitting here tonight. Al-Anons too. I yelled out something to the effect of, God, if there really is, please, please help me because I can't do anything. And almost immediately a thought was placed in my mind, and my mind said, have you tried AA? Well, I thought I knew about all about AA. In 1950, this kid that's talking right now went to the first international AA convention in Cleveland, Ohio. I was a 15, 16-year-old kid with my dad, who had been sober 6 months, got sober in Charlotte, North Carolina, in February the 10th of 1950. He hocked a vicuna coat and a little Crosley radio, and we took off in a 1948 Pontiac with a broken muffler and went to Cleveland, Ohio to the first AA conference. And there was only about 12 or 13, maybe 15 kids at that conference. Now, there was a fellow in AA called Clarence Snyder that's very, very, very controversial. Very controversial in AA. But let me tell you about Clarence. Clarence took us kids under his wing, he and his first wife, Dorothy. And they took us and they made sure that we had met all the big shots, you know. We met Dr. Bob and Bill and Sister Ignatia and Sam Shoemaker and Father Ed and all those folks, and took us out to his house on the lake, and we had hot dogs and hamburgers. They were wonderful to us. And I was an Alateen before there was such a word. And that was in 1950. And my dad, being new in AA, they did AA a little differently in those days. They had the net squad. My dad was the rookie on the net squad. And the new members were on probation. True. Were on probation in Charlotte for 6 months. And you broke you in right. And if you're on probation, you do all the dirty work. You mop the floors and you clean the toilets out, you know, down at the clubhouse. And you make the coffee. You get there an hour and a half early. And don't quibble. And we don't like snivelers in AA, is what they used to tell them. And they didn't give you a chance to say, well, I don't know if I like this or not. You know, you did steps 1, 2, and 3 on your knees the first 24 hours that you were in AA. And they used to sober them up on 67 years old, and there it goes, just or something. On paraldehyde and orange juice and honey and Coke syrup. And we had a basement in our house, so they'd bring the drunks down there so they couldn't get away as quick, you know, and lock the basement door, and, you know. And I'd have to go down and clean up after them the next morning. Guess what I said every time I had to clean up? I'm never going to drink. I'm never going to drink. Did you say that too? Yeah. I'm never going to drink. I see what it does to people. I didn't have a chance not to drink. Well, that's what I knew about AA. I thought AA was willpower. I thought my dad and all these great guys were just full of willpower. And I was real proud of my dad. I broke into that house on March the 1st of 1976 thinking that I'd try to have some willpower to stop drinking. I desperately wanted to. And I was shaking. You know how bad we shake. And my hands were sweaty. And I was filthy, dirty, and mucousy eyes. And didn't smell very good. And I picked up that phone. And I looked for a phone number in the phone book. And I had 20/10 vision in those days. And I was still very hard for me to read that, find that number. But I found it. And it almost glared off the page at me. And I called that number of the North Kansas City group. And somebody answered about 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And this was before noon meetings were vogue. But somebody was there. And they answered. And I said, I have a friend. And before I could say anything else, they said, is this friend in trouble? And I said, oh, no. You know, do you ever know a brand new drinking drunk that was ever in trouble? Nah, series of misunderstandings, a little tough luck, but, you know, nothing, only 16 warrants, you know, no big deal. And they said, well, do you have a car? I didn't want to think I was some Johnny come lately. And I said, sure. So 20 minutes later, I was driving a stolen car to my first AA meeting. That had started this time. Imagine that. And on my way to my first AA meeting down at 1824 Swift Avenue in North Kansas City, Missouri, another thought came to me. And I thought, now, catch this. I'm dressed in a wardrobe. I peed my pants for God knows how long. Haven't had a bath in God knows how long. Hadn't got a cent to my name. And a thought comes to me. I wonder if bad enough to have to go to AA, you know. Talk about ego. Well, I went. I walked up those steps, and the only door, AA door I've ever knocked on in my life, I knocked on that door, and somebody said, "Come in." And there he stood. And I never want to forget this. He was about 6'5", skinny as a rail. He had a big old bony hand stuck out and a smile as big as the outdoors on his face. And he says, "Hi, I'm Jack." And I literally had to turn around to see who was smiling at, because I knew it wasn't me. It had been a long, long time since anybody had smiled at Creighton Pendarvis. And I stuck an old mucusy, wet, shaking hand out. And I said, "I'm Creighton Pendarvis." And he said, "Would you run that name by just one more time?" The name's half Irish and half Greek. And I didn't know her stay drunk or open a restaurant for years, you know. So. And I said, "Well, you can call me Captain," because I wanted him to realize immediately that I was an airline captain, and as he could tell between trips. And he said, "Well, I'll call you Penn." So we sat down there, and I started shaking, and Jack said those magical words to a drinking drunk. Jack said, "You look like you need a drink." And I thought, what a deal. And Jack went down to his car, and like so many old-timers, and some of us still do, he carried a jug in the trunk of his car for guys named Creighton. And he brought that jug up, and I had a long, long pull off that jug. And I smoothed out, just like you would. And we started talking. And all of a sudden, I looked up at the front of the room, and like so many people, so many groups, they have the steps on one side and traditions on the other. And I looked up, and I said to Jack, I said, "Jack, I don't know if I can get this program or not." And he says, "Ah, don't worry about that word, God." And I thought, how the heck did he know? And we talked some more, and 8:30 came, 8:30 in the evening came. How It Works was read, and I convulsed, boom, right on the floor. And all of a sudden, I lay there convulsing, and a lot of folks started gathering around me, and we called them golden slippers, you know, every group's have them. In and out, in and out, in and out. Have enough white chips to tile a bathroom floor, you know. And they look like a tree full of owls looking at me, you know. Ooh, that really does happen, doesn't it? You know, we heard about these, we've never seen a live one, you know. Well, I can tell you, it's better to be a watcher than a flopper anytime. Thank God Doc Newton was there, and the rest of the bunch of the guys carried me back to the back room. They put a rubber sheet on the old couch, so if the captain wet his pants again, it wouldn't bleed through on the couch. Don't miss this. The members, the faces just like you and you and you and you and you, the faces in this room saved my life. And that's what our program is all about. Don't ever, 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 ever forget that. That you have in your hands the ability to actually save lives. And you went to the kitchen and you got the paraldehyde and the honey and the Coke syrup and the orange juice, and you came back with cold, wet wash claws, and you put them on my head, and you rubbed my head, and you held my hand, and you held that little tin pan, and I vomited that old green bile, and you said, "It's going to be all right, Creighton. It's going to be okay." And you fed me the paraldehyde and the honey and the orange juice. A lot of it came back up, but you saved my life. And I wanted to run. I wanted to cut and run. But I was so sick that I couldn't. Because you see, being the guy that can't look in the mirror, being so phony and knowing it yourself, that's the worst part, that you know it yourself. I couldn't. And I thought, God, I can't accept the kindness of these people. They don't know who I am. They don't know what a bum I am. They don't know what I've done. If they really knew the real Creighton Pendarvis, they would kick me out on the streets. Don't miss this. They did know the real Creighton Pendarvis, and that's why they weren't going to kick me out on the street. They were with me for 24 hours. Now, folks, that's a treatment center. I'm not throwing rocks at spin dry units or jitter joints. It's none of my business. But your own home group is a treatment center. Don't ever forget that. And I sound like I'm lecturing. I probably am, and I shouldn't. But you have the capability within your own home. You're not doctors. You're not doctors. Don't confuse that. But you have the medicine of the heart and the medicine of the soul to work wonders. The next day they decide the captain needs a bath. Boy, I agreed with that. And they took the captain's clothes off and discovered captains didn't wear underwear in those days, which easy to explain. You know, Aquavelva and Fruit of the Looms went for about the same price, and Aquavelva always won. You know what? So about an hour later, it's a true story. About an hour later, they came back and they said, "We got some good news and some bad news." And the good news is those pants, the zipper's unstuck. They shrunk up a little in the crotch, and you can wear that out a little bit. But the shoes are white again. You know, they look like Aladdin's. Their toes are curled up a little bit, and the shirt just evaporated. We don't know what the hell happened to it, but it's gone. And you can wear that old leather flying jacket around, and that's the way I came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was ungrateful. I was terribly, terribly, terribly ungrateful. I was a phony. I hadn't done anything to change, but it was warm inside there, and I had soup, and they took up a collection for me and got me a flop about two blocks from the AA hall at the Ben Boat Hotel in North Kansas City. Anybody ever been to the Ben Boat Hotel in North Kansas City? That's the stopping place for new drunks from the North Kansas City group. It's clean. It had a light bulb hanging down from the ceiling. A little cot for a bed, bathroom down the hall. It was cheap, and it was clean. And they gave you a towel and a wash rag and a bar of soap and a bottle of Listerine. And all for $3 a day. And what a deal that was. And I didn't have any money, but the members picked that tab up. And as ungrateful as I was, I just kind of expected that, you see. Because I'd been a taker all my life. A taker. And the only thing I gave in return was a lot of flack to a lot of people. About 3 or 4 weeks after that, I guess about 5 weeks after that, this guy was standing up like I am tonight before the Saturday night crowd. We had open meeting on Saturday night, and the rest of the time, 6 days a week, we had closed meetings. And this old geezer, he was older than Jerry, you know, and uglier. And he was standing up before the crowd, and he's holding this great big blown-up mugshot of himself up when he'd been throwing the slammer out in Hayes, Kansas for a DWI. He's holding it up here, and he says, "Now there I am drunk. Here I am sober." And like Jerry, he'll always look better drunk than he ever would sober, you know, just that kind of guy. And I thought, boy, what an old geezer. And I was sitting on Wino Row back, you know, nothing to do with you guys sitting back there, but I was sitting back there on Wino Row where all the newcomers sit, because that way we can say, there's a score over there, and that looks like an easy touch over there. And, you know, and we take in-depth inventory. We don't gossip in AA, but we share because we're very concerned about others. In fact, the meeting coming to here and tonight going home, you'll hear the best meeting in the world is going home when she said, "Did you see who she was with? Well, did you see who he was with? They won't stay sober 15 minutes." You know, that's great meetings. So we were sitting back there making judgments of this and that and the other thing. And the basket came around, and I thought it was more blessed to receive than give in those days. Had my hand in the basket, and all of a sudden, I felt this arm on mine, and it was that old geezer. And that old geezer said, "Boy, I'm going to break your arm if you do that." Well, I thought he could. I was four times bigger than he was. And he says, "And by the way, I'm your new sponsor." Oh. That is not what I wanted. But Ken Halstead became my sponsor, and thank God for guys named Ken Halstead. He was a big book thumper. And he was one of the greatest sponsors you could ever have in the world. He was not a touchy-feely guy, but he was a professional man, and he was a great, great sponsor. And Ken loved me to pieces. He never told me that. Well, he did later on, but I just worshiped Ken up until the time about 6 weeks after that, when I was mopping the floor, setting the chairs up for a Saturday night meeting in the hall, and I was all myself, and Ken came up that afternoon, and just the two of us in the hall, we were sitting there facing forward, sitting next to each other, and he put his arm around me up on my shoulder and gave me a little squeeze, and he says, "Son, what step do you think you're on?" And without batting an eye, and as serious as I am right this minute, I said, "Ken, having some trouble with number 9. All of a sudden, the old man's on the floor, and I think, "God, he's having a heart attack, laughing himself to death. You know, gives up, tears are coming out of his eyes, finger comes out, you know, and goes in my chest. He says, "Boy, you're on 1, and don't you forget it," you know. Well, it's times like these that the new members of Alcoholics Anonymous wish to God they had a car so they could crush their sponsor to death in the parking lot, you know. Boom, you old geezer. Well, that's the way I came into AA. A little bit about me. I was raised in Kansas. I grew up in a great home. My grandfather was a country doctor. And my grandparents raised me, and I had my first drink of alcohol when I was about 8 years old. My granddad was one of those sick drinkers, you know, three times a year. Armistice Day, New Year's Eve, and 4th of July. One glass of homemade wine. If that ain't sick drinking, I'll put in with you. But he loved to make wine, and he was a great, great, very spiritual man, very good man. And in the summer of my 8th birthday, we had a big flood in this little Kansas town and outbreak of typhoid. So I had to have a shot and inoculation. And in order to get me off the chandelier so he could give me an inoculation, he poured out a little jelly glass of wine. And, you know, I didn't pick it up to, you know, smell the bouquet and all that. You know, I just picked her up and drank her down. It got right about here. See if you identify. It got right about here, and kind of like a little bitty umbrella, it went, whoo. And I thought, man. And it protected me from you and everybody else. And I thought, why in the world does an 8-year-old kid need to be protected from anybody? But I didn't care. Because finally, I was that round peg that fit into the round hole. And I'd been a square peg all my life. But all of a sudden, I found something that took the edges off and I fit in. And I never forgot that feeling. Still kind of get excited about talking about it tonight, you know. But that's the first drink I had, and I'll never, ever forget that. That's not normal. That's not normal. Well, I was not a very good student. And I loved my grandfather, and I wanted to succeed. And I tried and tried and tried in every way I could. And my grandmother said to me, "The best way you can please your grandfather is to make some good grades." So I worked very, very hard one 9-week period into the 4th grade, and I brought home 5 A's and 1 B. Now, there's a star in the east when Creighton brings home 5 A's and 1 B, because it just wasn't capable of me. And I brought them home, and I was so proud, and came home at dinner time. We called lunchtime dinner in the farm communities in those days. And I brought those grades home and showed my grandmother, and she hugged me to her bosom, and she says, "Your grandfather's going to be so proud." And I couldn't wait till my granddad got home, and he came home, and he sat down at his place at the table, put his little glasses on, picked up my grade cards, looked at them, looked at me, and guess what he said? That B needs some improvement. I was crushed. My grandmother gave him a very stern look. But here's the other side. Here's the dichotomy. Here's the paradox. Here's the other side. From the second story window of my bedroom that evening, I heard my grandfather down on the driveway saying to Emma Hoxley, the widow lady that lived next door, "Emma, Emma, Creighton made 5 A's and 1 B, and I'm so proud of him." And I thought to my little 9 or 10 year old self, why in God's name couldn't you tell me that? The gentlemen in this crowd were the same way, I bet you. Or a lot of, not all of us, but a lot of us. At least the guy that's talking right now. And that machoism and that ego and that other crap that I carried around for so long, I couldn't tell my kids how proud of them I was. They had to pull up their own socks, straighten up. Or sometimes I'd say, "You gotta straighten up, you know." And that does not, that doesn't do anything for kids except make them dislike you a lot. I love those kids so much, and it's so easy for me to tell them that I love them. I kiss my sons now. I'm not a, you know, in public I kiss my sons. And I love them so much. And my grandkids, oh, we spoil them rotten. They put peanut butter on the television controls and they put jelly in my slippers and I just love it, you know. And then I say, "Go home and show Daddy your new trick." Yeah. I was not a good student. I footballed my way through school, through high school. I went to live with my dad, as I said, in 50. Footballed my way through high school. Had a scholarship at the University of North Carolina and played football there. I didn't graduate. I ran out of eligibility. And I was picked up by the Washington Redskins, and I played 2 years of pro football. And I was drinking more and enjoying it more all the time. It kind of tells you back the difference between us and them, us in the 50s playing pro ball, and those people that play pro ball today is our half times, we smoked Camel cigarettes and drank Ballantine beer. And of course, we were only paid about $6,000-$7,000 a year. Our bonus is $1,500 if we won over 500 games. If we won more than 10 games, we won. Our bonus was $3,000. We never made $3,000. We were so bad. About that time, the military draft was catching up with me, and I took some tests because I was hanging out with a bunch of Marines from Quantico, Virginia. And I took some tests to go to flight school. Now, I thought I was dumber than dirt. I was a history major with no college degree, but I had 4 years of college. And I passed these tests. And off to flight school I went with a little detour down to Parris Island, South Carolina, for a little camping experience because I didn't show up for troop movement on time. And the Marine Corps frowned on that. And anyway, I went through flight school, and I loved it. And I found something that I was good at. And I found something that I loved. And I graduated and was made an officer and gentleman by act of Congress and pinned gold wings on me, and off to El Toro, California I went. And I met and married a wonderful lady out there, and we had a child right away. And all of a sudden I was flying the hottest thing the Marine Corps had at that time as a very junior officer. And that wasn't skill, that was just luck. It just happened that way. And Tom and I Tom Schellinger, my friend that I talked about earlier, he and I went out there, and he would try to keep me out of trouble most of the time. I could fly off your wing 3 feet at .92 Mach. That's about 580 miles an hour. And be the most responsible person you ever met in your life. And I literally trusted you with my life, and you trusted me literally with your life. And I was good at that. And I'd land that aircraft and open that canopy and pop that oxygen mask off to one side and light that Camel cigarette and put my arms up on that canopy rail and think, man, I wonder what the poor folks are doing today, you know, because here comes Captain Marvelous, you know, Lieutenant Marvelous in those days. And I was full of it. And I'd taxi that aircraft in and I'd park it. And I'd get out and go to the equipment room and hang up my gear. And then the normal thing is you go home. But I didn't know how to act. 5 minutes before, I'd been flying at close to the speed of sound, 3 feet off some guy's wing, in a very high-performance airplane, very responsible. And now I'm on the ground, and I have a responsibility of a daughter and a wife, and I didn't know how to handle it. I really, really didn't know how to handle it. So what do? You go with the officer's club, and you pop two or three. And all of a sudden, you're looking at that mirror, that back mirror in that bar. And all of a sudden, by George, you got black, wavy hair coming in here, you know. By the way, you think I'm not still full of denial? I carry a comb. But that long, black, wavy hair would come in. I never had long, black, wavy hair in my life. You know, I had a dimple right here in the chin. Those steely green eyes would come in, you know, and that arm of steel. And I was a lover and a killer. Well, you know, weighed about 212 pounds. Couldn't lick my lips and had been impotent for about 9 months, you know, and had 75 cents worth of chili running right down the front of me. And I'd turn to some lovely sitting down there and I'd say, which is drunkie talk for high, gorgeous, high-fly jets, you know. Well, they'll move out of the room for every once in a while, one would go, and off into a meaningful relationship you'd go for a while. Been there, hadn't you? Yeah. And I'd dream another dream and fall off another bar stool, and that gal got tired of me. And I wonder why. And the baby wondered dad at home. And I didn't know how to act. So I played the best game I could, and that's run, drink, run. And I ran back overseas, and it was easy to do in those days because we were coming up on a big war. And I ran overseas, and about 3-4 weeks after I'd been overseas, I was standing at a stiff brace before my commanding officer. And he looked up at me, and he says, "You're a bum." And I thought, the word's out. They know. Because you see, in here, I'd known I'd been a bum for a long, long, long time. When you read how it works, in that first part, when we read how it works, let me share something with you. Now, this is just Pendarvis talking. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program, usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. You know what that means? You can't look in the mirror. That's all it means. You can't look in the mirror. Because if you look in the mirror, you see somebody that's a monster. And that monster you can't stand. And that monster is someone that you have to live with because they're inside your skin, so you avert your eyes and have another drink. And that monster goes away for a while. And if you have enough drinks, then you can look in that mirror and that long black wavy hair comes in. Yeah. And then the next day, as you're hanging over the porcelain perch, you have to look up and see that monster again. And all of a sudden it becomes cyclical. And the cycle turns and turns and turns. There's another part down here that is so, so, so important on how to put the brakes on this. It took me a long time how to find out. And it says, if you've decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any lengths to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. Then you're ready to take certain steps. A lot of people say, well, I'm going to give up on that when I think they're in and out and in and out. They just ain't ready. The pitiful part about it is some of those folks die before they're ready, or they kill somebody before they're ready. How lucky we are in this room tonight. How lucky we are in this room. A lot of sober faces. You may think you're carrying the weight of the world on your shoulders. God gives the big loads to Tom Schellinger and people like that. And God gives the big loads to some people in this room too. The guy's named Pendarvis never had a big load in his life. He thought he did. But it was all ego and macho and all this crap because I couldn't face the monster in the mirror. And I walked out of that officer's, my commanding officer's office that morning, and the first thing I said was, "That bitch. How could she do this to me?" What was I really saying? What was I really saying? I was embarrassed. And I was carrying enough guilt for 20 people. In fact, my two new roommates were called Guilt and Remorse. And they slept with me every morning. And they'd awaken and they'd say, "Good morning, Creighton," and reach in my gut. And I'd have to have a drink to make them go away. That's a heck of a way to live. That lady divorced me, thank God, and took our daughter and made a life for herself. Well, that didn't stop me. You know, I didn't do anything differently. So I trapped another one. And we married, and God love her, she was going to save me or try to. We had another child, and nothing had changed, except I was drinking more and enjoying it less. And all of a sudden, it had become a have-to thing instead of a social obligation. And back overseas I went, and this time they were shooting. And I went out one morning, and it wasn't with Tom, it was another good friend of mine, close friend of mine. And I was going to be lead that morning, and we were headed north. And I was in a blackout. I came out of the blackout as I got up on the ladder outside the cockpit, and swung the chute in and put my helmet up on the glare shield. And all of a sudden, I thought, "Am I going out on a mission, or am I coming back from one?" And that's a hell of a place to be, especially when you're going to lead your best friend you've ever had in your life into a combat situation. About 15 or 20 minutes later, I came to in another blackout, came out of that blackout again, and we were at a low altitude, which we were supposed to be, at a very, very high rate of airspeed. And I came out of that blackout, and I turned, and Terry was tucked in just exactly where he should have been. The problem was I'd gone up the wrong valley. And we picked up the ground fire, horrible ground fire, and I turned into my wingman and I killed him in the snap of an eye. And then the monster became overpowering. And in those hospitals, I'd look in that mirror and I grew a beard because I couldn't look in the mirror anymore. And I'd have to drink as much as I possibly could. That wife, I told her, I said, "You know, they're going to give me the courtesy of resigning from the military instead of kicking me out, and I've got a job lined up with an airline. And honey, I'm going to turn over new leaf number 642 or whatever it was by this time, and I'm going to do it differently." Now, Al-Anons, listen to me, please. If I had taken a lie detector, or if your mate had taken a lie detector, or if your significant other had taken a lie detector at that time, we would have passed. Because we sincerely believed that we were going to turn over a new leaf. Because we desperately wanted to. And so for almost a year, I didn't drink as much. And I became a little responsible. And I joined the Rotary Club and the Kiwanis and this and that and the other thing and the JCs. And I sold more Christmas trees than any other guy did. And, you know, I canvassed more new members and this and that and the other thing. And I was flying for this airline out of Kansas City, Missouri. And then the time came, I couldn't take it anymore. And I was mowing the grass one afternoon. And I was falling over, tripping over the holes I'd dug for the white picket fence. Never got the white picket fence put up, but got the holes dug. And I'd trip over and say, "You've got to put that damn fence up one of these days." And I said, "Boy, a cold beer would taste good." And off to the races I went. I was voted Young Man of the Year by the Kansas City Chamber, Junior Chamber of Commerce in 1968, in the summer of 1968. By December of 1968, I was in the state insane asylum, the real jitter joint, with no knobs on my side of the door. And I'd been sitting naked in trees, falling out of them, revealing my shortcomings. And she had committed me. And then she left, thank God, to make a life for herself. My chief pilot came up and he got me out of there. He said, you know, it'd be bad for ticket sales if they found you in here and the newspapers got a hold of it. I didn't know how to act any other way. And the monster by this time had taken over the mirror. So I bought an electric shaver, and I'd shave that way, never looking in the mirror. And the only time I'd look in the mirror was after three or four Everclear martinis. And then I could afford to look in the mirror, because by that time I was Mr. Big again, you see. And all this stuff was in my gut. And all this stuff was eating me alive, because I hadn't figured out steps 1, 2, and 3. Didn't know anything about it. And people would say, well, the only difference is us standing here at this bar and them what goes to AA meetings is we don't go to the meetings. Ha, 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 ha. How true it was. I flew all over the world. I was an international pilot, and I literally flew on every continent in the world except Antarctica. And people would say, well, how was Hong Kong? Great bar. They'll build you a suit while you're sitting at the bar in Hong Kong. But how was Johannesburg? Great bar. How was Paris? Great bar. How was Stockholm? Super bar. How was Tokyo? Great bar. How was Lima? Bad jail. Great bar. And I was doing what was natural, which is, you know, golfers golf and fishermen fish and drunks drink. And that's what I was doing. And then that day came. I never had a DWI in a car, but I did in the 727 when I ran it off the icy runway at Kansas City. I wasn't drunk. I blew a high alcohol content, which was pretty normal for all of us. And it just slid off. I've been stone cold sober, and it slid off. But the company was looking for a reason to fire me, and I breathed a sigh of relief because, whew, I was finally out of that. And I didn't have to embarrass myself or the company anymore, and they'd been so, so good to me. That was in 1974, January. For the next 2 years, a lot of things happened to me that are none of your business. As a matter of fact, this is not a fifth step. But suffice it to say that I got in trouble where there's trouble. And I did some things that I'm terribly ashamed of. And I went to work for a branch of our government that nobody talks about. And there I met every drunk pilot that had ever been cashiered out of an airline or the military. And we did a pretty good job. May the 5th of 1975, Phnom Penh fell. And we were out of a job again. I ended up in that box. And When I got to AA, I didn't want to be phony anymore, but I didn't know how. Because, you see, I had such low self-esteem, perhaps like you did. I hated myself. And the wind called loneliness blew through my guts at 120 miles an hour, whether I had a 10-cent T-shirt on or a $1,000 suit, just like you. And I could be in a room full of people just like this. And there's somebody in this room right now that wind called loneliness is blowing through their gut. My friend, it doesn't have to happen. It just doesn't have to happen. And it'll take more guts than the Russian army has for you to say hi to somebody. But do it. And they'll hug you. And they'll love you too. Because, you see, they know you better than your mom does. They know what you're going through or have been through. And that's what makes this program successful. It ain't the dances on Saturday night, contrary to popular belief, you know. It's the loving in our meetings, and it's the working with the newcomer. God bless newcomers, you see. You know, a lot of things have happened to me since sobriety. Let me share two or three and then I'll sit down. I was selling food. My first job, my sponsor got me a first job in Kansas City when I'd been sober 3 weeks. He said, "You have to have a job." And I said, "But I'm waiting for them to rehire me, you know." And the FAA had taken my ticket away so long ago, it wasn't even funny. In fact, I couldn't even go near airports. And so my sponsor got me a job, and I became a China mechanic, dishwasher. But, you know, I always had to have a fancy name to it, you know. Vice President and General Manager of the Universe, as old Norm Alpe used to say. And I was a dishwasher, and it humbled me to the point where I tried to get a job with this food broker, and I kept badgering him to the point where he hired me. So I traveled to Northwest Missouri with a car, a 1965 Dodge Dart that my sponsor bought for me for $500 or $600. But it had a good engine and it ran good, and I'd haul these supplies up to Northwest Missouri. And there was a place called Conception Abbey. And Conception Abbey was up in the northwestern corner of Missouri. And it was a Benedictine monastery. And they were one of my clients. One day I was up there and I was talking to Brother Tom, who ran the kitchen. I said, "What is going on today?" It was a beautiful April morning. The birds were chirping and the grass was growing. Flowers were springing out. And the bells were ringing. He says, "Well, this is the 200th anniversary of the Abbey. And this is a feast day. Well, why don't you go over and take a look in the cathedral?" Well, I'm not big on cathedrals, you know, and I didn't want to test the structural integrity of same. But anyway, to please him, I went over there and I walked in, and these huge, huge, big oaken doors. And I opened the doors, and as I walked in on this beautiful stone, not marble, but just stone floor, and it was cool and quiet. And all of a sudden, the Gregorian chants started from the cloisters, almost on cue. I'm not big on Gregorian chants. And all of a sudden, I felt the hair on my neck stand up and goosebumps. And about that time, some clouds moved away from the sun, and a shaft of light, and I'm going to cry telling this, a shaft of light came down about 8, 9, 10, 12 feet in front of me. And I fell to my knees and I said, "There is a God, and that God loves me." And all of a sudden, step two was so easy for me. So, so easy. And I got up from that, and it started my journey in AA. Did I walk on water and glow in the dark after that? Obviously not. But what it did, just like something will happen in your life, it'll open that door a little bit. It could be something that a sponsor says or a newcomer says, but it'll be something that somebody says or an experience like that. You don't have to have a burning bush. But all of a sudden, I went back to Ken and I told him what happened, and we both cried. And for the first time in our relationship, we hugged each other. And he says, "You've changed. You've changed." Well, about 2 weeks after that, he says, "I want you to go down to Oklahoma City and talk to the FAA. I said, "Ken, you don't understand. The FAA never, ever, 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 ever wants to see me again. They told me so, you know." He says, "Well, I want you to talk to this doctor down there." So, on my way to Oklahoma City, I thought, what in the world am I doing? And I asked Ken, I said, "Well, what in the God's name am I going to tell these people?" And he says, "The truth. Try the truth for once. See how that works." That's new to me. I walked into this office and this lady says, "May I help you?" And I said, "I'm Creighton Pendarvis." "Oh, you're Creighton. Boy, you know, when you meet somebody that doesn't know you, you know, you light up like a Christmas tree." Almost had my hands out like this, you know. And she says, "Well, doctor will see you in just a minute." And so I sat down and I waited and I was apprehensive. and my blood pressure is about 240 over 135 probably. And this guy all of a sudden didn't even bother to get up. He says, "Come in here, boy." And this old gruff so-and-so, again, like Jerry here, sitting down there and sitting behind his desk. And I came in and he says, "Sit down, boy." And I sat down and he says, "What can I do for you?" So I started telling him my spiel. And after about 3 or 4 minutes into my spiel, he pulls something out of his pocket and he tosses it up on the desk there, and I pick it up, and it says, "To thine own self be true." And it had an X, had a 5, and 2 1s. And Dr. Audie Davis had been sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous for 17 years. And I said, "You know Halstead, don't you?" He says, "He is my first sponsor." And I walked out of the FAA office with a ticket to fly commercially that afternoon. There's only a couple of us that's ever happened to. Lyle P., whom a lot of you know, is the other one. Miracles happen to people like Lyle and Creighton and people like you. Expect a miracle because it's going to happen. It will happen. The other miracles that have happened to me is I've stayed sober in spite of me. In spite of living with me, with all my crap. You know, I looked up that daughter of mine, that oldest daughter of mine, and wrote her an amends letter. And I hadn't seen her in 17 years. Didn't even know where she lived because her mother had remarried and her stepfather had adopted her. So I didn't even know where she was. And by this time I'd gone to Dallas, Texas, because I'd gotten that job back with that airline that said, "Don't ever come on our property again." Now, I'd like to tell you I was welcome back with open arms, and I wasn't. But at least I was back, and I worked very, very hard to try to make some amends. And I had a long, long, long night step list with that airline. I got a letter after I wrote a night step letter from that daughter. And I opened it, and the first line says, "Dear Daddy, I love you." From a daughter I hadn't seen in 17 years. Tell me miracles don't happen. And she went on to say that she wanted to see me. And she knew about alcoholism. And she knew it was a disease. And so we got together. And she and I had a wonderful, wonderful reunion. I'd like to tell you it was just like the first time, you know, that nothing had ever happened. Well, that's ridiculous. A lot of water had gone over that bridge. But today she and I correspond, and she and her mate live outside of Philadelphia, and she did well. They travel all around the world, and Paige doesn't have to work. And I think, ooh, damn, you know, something rubbed off on her, you know. And she goes to a lot of Al-Anon. Imagine that. The other daughter, the little fireball, she was 16 years old and suffering from anorexia and hated my guts. And I went up to be with her in a treatment modality in Spokane, Washington. And all the hate came out. And the hate of her father. And she used to call me on Father's Day or my birthday and say, "Happy birthday," or "Happy Father's Day, you GDSOB," and hang up. And it was a hate-love relationship. And she hated me so bad, or at least she thought she did. And I came back to Dallas, where I was living at the time, and I went to David and I said, "Man, I am so angry at me. That monster is starting to creep back in the mirror." And the monster really had not totally left the mirror yet. But it was starting to come back in the mirror. And I said, "I can't stand it." And he says, "Talk to Gracie." And if any of you know Gracie Aronofsky, she is black belt Al-Anon. And that weekend, a gal by the name of Lois Chamberlain just happened to be in town. And Lois and Gracie took me to my first Al-Anon meeting. Well, big shot me. You know, I walk in and sit down and we go around introducing ourselves. And I said, "I'm Creighton Pendarvis, and I'm an alcoholic." Ouch! And all of a sudden, I felt the a horrible kick in my shin. In fact, Ray Nitschke didn't kick me that hard when we were playing ball together, you know. And it was Lois Chamberlain. And with those little thin blue lips of hers and those big, beautiful blue eyes, she says, "Creighton, don't ever introduce yourself as an alcoholic in an Al-Anon meeting. Sorry for the kick." And I've never forgotten that lesson since. What happened to me in Al-Anon is this. AA cleaned me up, sobered me up, and gave me the rudiments of a program to live by. Al-Anon, in the last 16 years, has given me a route, a path from my head to my heart. And my children love the fact that I'm a double winner. Because I've learned how to, through Al-Anon, how to say, "Well, how important is it?" instead of saying some other things that aren't appropriate. And I'd like to tell you, I want to say thank you to the family group. Because I was an Alateen before there was Alateen. And I've come back home to the Al-Anons. My mother, and I'll close. My mother was a dear, sweet lady. I thought she had deserted me. In a way, she had. But she'd been married to a bad drunk in a little bitty Kansas town where her father was kind of a patriarch. And she had to get out of town. And she'd done the best she knew how to do. It's another thing Al-Anon taught me, is she was doing the very best she knew how to do. And what happened was that when I got sober in 1976, I wanted to reach out to my mother because I kind of had that hate-love relationship like Tracy had with me. And finally, my sponsor says, "Well, you're going to have Christmas dinner with us, aren't you?" And I said, "Well, yeah, I'd like to." He says, "Why don't you invite your mother?" And I thought, "Oh, Ken, you don't know what you're asking." I said, "She hates me, and she hasn't seen me in a long, long time." You see, I used to go down to my mother's house, my sweet little mother, in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And I was making a bucket full of money. I was flying international captain, DC-8s, international. Big bucks. But I never had any. I used to go down to my mom's house and say, "I need some money." And she'd always give it to me. But this time I went down and put the key in the door and it wouldn't open. And I knocked on the door, and she came to the door, and I said, "Mom, something's wrong with the key." And she says, "No, Creighton, I changed the locks." And I said, "Well, I need some money, and then I'll get out of here." And she says, "I'm going to say this to you, and it'll hurt me worse than it'll hurt you, but I can't give you any more money. I can't do anything more for you. You're killing yourself, and I don't want to be part of it." And I stood in the front porch of 1524 East 20th Street of Tulsa, Oklahoma, and I swore at my mother, using every foul word that I'd ever known in my life, in a very loud voice. And why did I do that? Because of the monster in the mirror. Who was I swearing at? The mirror! Not my mother. But I was swearing because of fear. That four-letter word, fear, self-centered fear, that I had brought on myself through ego, dishonesty, and a lot of other things. So you see, it was very difficult for me to pick up a telephone and call my mother in December of 1976. But I obeyed my sponsor because he gave me good orderly direction. And I called my mom, and she said, "Creighton, I would love to come." And I said, "Mom, I don't have money for airfare, but I'll send you a bus ticket." Well, she had money to fly. But she gave me the pride to let me buy her a bus ticket to Kansas City from Tulsa. And I met her at the bus station in that old 1965 Dodge Dart. And all of a sudden, you know, years and years and years of disagreement and years and years and years of dislike and untrustfulness melted away as we hugged each other. And we had a wonderful Christmas. And I said, "Ken, how did you know my mother would come?" And he said, "Oh, I called her a month ago." In 1992, December of 1992, by then I'm going to say this, and it really isn't braggadocious on my part, but there's people in this audience that may be lower than anything tonight, and you may be down on your luck, and especially with the job market and all this, and you think you're never going to amount to a hill of beans. Well, God and I know better, and it may not be the greatest thing that you ever wanted. Nobody in here is in line for presidency of the United States or even governor of Georgia. But there's a lot of other jobs that you're capable of. And I didn't think I'd ever amount to a hill of beans. I thought I'd be a dishwasher and a food broker, and maybe, just maybe, I might get on flying a mail plane someplace. 11 years, almost to the day I was made vice president of Northwest Airlines, 11 years from the day that I crawled out from under that box. It happens. It happens in God's time. I'm not bright enough to figure out how to do all those things, except I suited up and showed up every day and tried to do the best I could and didn't lie near as much as I used to and was a lot more honest. And that's all it took. And went to meeting after meeting after meeting and listened to my sponsor most of the time. Okay? And that's what happens. I was with Northwest, and my mother in 1992 died in her front room. Unfortunately, and I say this with great love, her little friend of hers was there and called 911, and they brought her back. And she suffered a great deal because she'd been dead too long. And so on March the 19th, my little mother passed away. And I was able to go to Tulsa, Oklahoma, and be there at the memorial and lead a memorial service for my dear, sweet mother. And I don't think I'd ever been more blissful in my life. I was sad, but I cried for joy because she was out of pain, and she and I had mended fences. Don't leave here tonight without starting to mend some fences, or think about mending some fences that need mending, because it'll bring you joy, it'll bring you happiness far beyond your greatest expectations in the program called Alcoholics Anonymous. Direct gifts from God. Thanks be to you, God, for my life, that I live in a home and not in a box under a bridge or in a cell in an institution. Thanks be to you, God, for carrying me to AA's doorstep and letting the members save my life. And thanks, God, for my children and my grandchildren who love me and respect me. And thanks again, God, for allowing me to retire from my wonderful business I love, that of flying. And thanks, God, for my wife and for my mother, who are my closest allies. But most of all, God, thanks for never having forgotten my name. Thanks a million, Athens. Good night.